Life is a teacher, time is a healer, and I'm a believer, like a river wild. Ego's a killer, greed is a monster, but love is stronger, stronger than them all. If I can hand, I don't wanna fight. No lines in the sand, I'm on your side. Invisible, no color lines. It's time we put our differences aside.
And welcome to All This and the Oscars Too, awardsdaily.com's podcast on the Oscars and film and everything else. My name is Sasha Stone. I'm the founder and editor of awardsdaily.com. I'm here with Ryan Adams and Marshall Flores, two editors from awardsdaily.com. And we are here together again. Hi, guys.
Hello. Hello.
Hey, hey, hey.
That's Marshall and that's Ryan. Actually, that's Ryan and that's Marshall, respectively. We're talking about a lot of award season, a lot of award shows and announcements coming up in the next 2 weeks. First up is going to be the Spirit Awards on Tuesday. They're going to have a press conference and they're going to announce the nominees. So we'll talk a little bit about that and then talk about some of the movies we think that are worth paying attention to right now. The Post is about to start screening and then in a week, so will Phantom Thread. And then our Oscar season will be all wrapped up, and we can talk about what movies we think right now are the hottest on the ticket. So
sounds good. I think, I think Jazz said she was going to see The Post tonight.
Yep.
I might have misunderstood her, but I think she's
going
to see it tonight.
I'm going too. I'm supposed to go. That's what I have to. Why I have to leave at 5:30.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I really don't want to, because I'm just so like not into driving all the way over there. But I couldn't live farther away from Fox. That's the truth. I literally have to go from one end of the valley all the way over to the other end of Los Angeles County. But the first screening is going to have Bradley Whitford and the screenwriter. And the screening on the, then they're going to have another one with just Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks. And then on the 27th, which I'm going to go to also, is going to be Steven Spielberg, Meryl Streep, Tom Hanks, and everybody else. So that's, I really want to see that. I was just going to go to the 27th, but since everybody's going to be there today, I thought I'd just go see this one, get it out of the way, and then go see it again on the 27th.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
So we'll finally know tonight. We'll finally be hearing from people. I mean, but I don't think before today there's been no one who's come forth publicly who has any substantial credibility who's seen The Post and knows what to say about it.
Right.
So we haven't known what to think about it.
No, I mean, the only thing that we know is that they're bringing out all the talent to the screenings, and that's never a good sign. But I'm keeping an open mind. Hopefully it'll be good. But usually when they blitz you with all the stars at the screening, like it's like Unbroken, you know, they're nervous. Something is making them nervous. Otherwise, they just would screen it and they wouldn't bring out the fanfare. But they're bringing out the fanfare because there's a reason for that. So I guess we'll find out what that reason is. But I'm not going to pass up a chance to see Steven Spielberg in person, which would be like
the coolest
thing ever, not to mention Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks. So
maybe Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks both are just feel so confident about it that they think they're going to win their fifth and fourth Oscars or whatever.
No, I don't think so. I think it's more like we're worried about this movie and we want to help as much as we can to give it a good, because, you know, the way it works in interviews and stuff and these things is the reason they want you to meet people. They want you to always, and I'm so bad at this because I have weird shyness disorder and I can't do it. So thank God for Jazz that she can, but she has no problem going to parties and hanging out with people and stuff. And to me, it's just like the worst thing. I know it sounds crazy, but it really is. It's just the thing that I can't stand more than anything else. But within my business, if I could just do my site from my house and never have to go anywhere, that's how I'd prefer it. But but you have to go, you know, you have to go out. But they want you to meet them because once you see them and you're familiar with them, you feel like you have some kind of personal connection. And that makes you more positive about the whole thing, and it makes you root for them. And I know this is true because when I saw James Franco do The Disaster Artist, and I actually saw him come out on stage, and he was so charismatic. God, he was like one of the most charismatic actors I've ever seen in person was James Franco. And you wouldn't really know that from his work on screen necessarily, you know? But God, he was like, whoa. I mean, it was really, really strong, hardcore charisma. And I thought, wow, that's what's making me think he might get an Oscar nomination is because of that. If they keep bringing him out and he keeps meeting with people, he has a really good shot. And speaking of which, Marshall was watching The Room and quoting The Room on Twitter last night.
A little bit, yeah. No, it's just, oh, hi, Mark.
I did not hit her. I did not.
First, the dialogue itself in the screenplay is just so bland and just routine. And then the way they deliver it is almost robotic. It's almost like a robotic telephone voice or something.
I revisited The Room and it was basically just as hard for me to like actually sit through, and it's only like a 90 minute film or something. It's not very long, but just, you know, I mean, really like the best way, or for me, like, you know, I'd rather just watch like all the highlight clips like they have on YouTube or it's like all the funny stuff, because just like that first 10 minutes, it's just like so bad.
I will admit that I really only got halfway through it. I haven't watched it through all the way to the very end, because that first half an hour of that movie is like two softcore sex scenes back to back that are virtually identical to each other. They even use some of the same shots.
Exactly.
Some of the same shots that are in the first sex scene are recycled into the second sex scene. And it's so obvious that they're doing that. So the first half hour of the movie is like softcore porn.
That's the whole joke of it. Like, that's the one of the things.
Yeah, that's from what I've read. Like, the second sex scene basically uses shots from the first sex scene and unused footage from the first sex scene. Yeah. So yeah, it's just like, just like the foreplay, like the really prolonged foreplay in that thing. So painfully like extendedly long. It's just like,
The girl who plays,
I wasn't kidding. Do you remember I said the first time we talked about it, it takes him like a full 2 minutes to get his necktie off during the foreplay.
I love the girl who plays Lisa. I think she's so good. Like, they couldn't quite match her in the Disaster Artist. Like, whoever that actress was, like, there's just something so funny about the way her delivery, the way she looks, everything about her is just so perfect. The one that they cast in the Disaster Artist is more likely just like a normal actress. Like, doesn't have that same. And then what about Denny?
This is just the strangest goddamn thing. He just like, they go upstairs for their nap and then he follows them up.
Right. He's sitting there. He knows they're about to have sex, but he just nonchalantly says, "I just think I'll hang out and watch if that's okay with you."
And then halfway through the movie, he's like, "I think I'm in love with Lisa."
Like, three's a crowd, Denny.
Denny has to be the funniest character in the whole movie. He's like, "I'm in love with Lisa." Anyway, it's a really funny movie. I hope people continue to
see it. Yeah, no, I'm really... I actually just finally watched like the trailers for Disaster Artist this weekend. Yeah, I'm really interested in it now, especially since like doing the comparison of Franco and Tommy.
I really do recommend it. Anyone, I mean, I haven't seen The Disaster Artist yet, but I don't think you can fully comprehend or fully appreciate what Franco has done unless you see the original, what they're playing off of, what they're replicating. And I really don't think that the YouTube clips do it justice either, because so much of what is bad about the movie is the very strange pacing of the movie. Yeah. The way that it just is 90 minutes or 100 minutes of nothing happening. And you don't catch that if you just see the highlights on YouTube, because it seems like it might almost be good if it's all like that, but it's not all like that. It's just a bunch of
James
nothing.
Franco has to play, like, he has to play, why his performance is so good is that he's not just playing Danny or Tommy Wiseau in the movie, he's playing Tommy Wiseau and then Tommy Wiseau acting in The Room.
Like, Tommy Wiseau is Johnny, the vampire.
Right, it has to be two different. Tommy Wiseau as Johnny. But he can't, most people doing that would just play his character. Like, "I did not hit her. I did not." But right. They wouldn't do James Franco. They wouldn't do Tommy Wiseau, the actual Tommy Wiseau. And that's what James Franco does. It's so funny. It's really good. Anyway, so back to the subject at hand. We have...
How did we get off on that? We're talking about Best Actor. That's what
I don't even know how we got off on it. But, but Spirit Awards. Okay, so the difference between the Spirit Awards and... the Gothams is that the, I mean, you know, the Gothams are like five people each category who pick, right? So it's like,
The nominee, it's like they have a nominating committee, I think. And yeah, you're right. I think there's, they select five people from the group and five critics. And then they choose a category.
Yeah. I don't think the Spirit Awards works that way. I think it's, I mean, does anybody know? God.
The Spirit Awards has a nominating committee, too. And I don't know that we even know exactly who they are. But they're like the elite members of the Spirit Awards community. But actually, you know, anybody can vote on the final ballot of the Spirit Awards if you join the Spirit Awards community. They have some sort of method of weighting the ballots so that just, I mean, I think what it amounts to is anybody with $100 can join the Spirit Awards and vote in the Spirit Awards and get screeners if you want to join, and they approve you to join if you have any kind of credibility at all, which is a little bit strange, you know, when you think about it. At the same time, they do select really good movies because they have good nominations.
All right. So Film Independent, this is from their website. Film Independent assembles nominating committees, which are made up of working members of the film community. Committees typically include a mix of film critics, film programmers, producers, directors, writers, cinematographers, editors, actors, past nominees and winners, and member of Film Independent's board of directors. Film Independent staff are not voting members of any nominating committees. we have separate committees for American narrative, international, and documentary films. Additionally, there are four nominating committees for our producers, Someone to Watch, Truer Than Fiction, and Bonnie Awards. These committees select three nominees, including the winner for each specific grants. They don't say how many people do the choosing, right? So that's really what I'm more interested in, is how many people are on their nominating committee, you know?
Yeah, that would be interesting to find out. The way that the Spirit Awards manages to maintain such high credibility, I think, though, is they do, whoever is on those nominating committees, do a very, really excellent job, I think. The set of nominees they give us every year, year after year after year, are so high quality across the board that it doesn't, that no matter who wins out of the five that they nominate, it's going to be a good choice because their nominations are just that good. They're really solid. They have a lot of really good independent films to choose from, and they know what they're doing, and they pick the cream of the crop to nominate, I think.
Right. I mean, it's lately it's becoming more Oscar friendly, like Oscars are becoming more Spirit Awards friendly and vice versa, or at least for the last 3 or 4 years, where, you know, Moonlight, Spotlight, Birdman, all these movies dominated both awards. And that's because, as you saw by what I just announced, which was the type of people that do the nominating, those, that's not that different from the Academy. If you're talking about film, people who work in film, you're talking about basically drawing from the same group of people, just a smaller sample size. So they have rules, I think, about budget and stuff like that, don't they? Like,
yes, there's a budget ceiling of $20 million.
So whatever.
So that's the one thing they have in common with the Gothams. The Gothams apparently have the same sort of budget cap.
Yeah.
I don't know that it's hard. They stick to that $20 million right on the dot. I think they're a little bit flexible, like $22 million, or, you know, they can accept. It just depends, I think, on whether or not a movie is produced under the auspices of a major studio or not, is the main thing. But they do have a general rule of the $20 million budget cap.
All right, so we know for a fact that Lady Bird is probably going to be in because it's very this kind of crowd friendly. I mean, it's practically like it was made for the Spirit Awards. Like, everything about it is aimed at this, you know, it's not aimed at, but that's the crowd right there, you know?
Greta Gerwig herself, Greta Gerwig herself is like the goddess of independent film, right? Isn't she? She's like the princess of independent movie making.
Yeah, and she is. And she is going to be celebrated up one side and down the other at the Spirit Awards. Mm-hmm. This is going to be her big, big moment. But it might cross over to the Oscars, too. You never know. But so we expect that. We expect Get Out for sure. That's like, you know, an independent Spirit Award, you know, fantasy, because it made, what, like $170 million and only cost like $7 million or something.
Yeah, it was like a $5 million budget. So, I mean, even though it was financed by, you know, Universal, or distributed to Universal, I mean, the subject matter was still very original and provocative. And that is one of the nominating criteria that the Spirit Awards uses. So it's Get Out's definitely going to be at play.
Yeah, and Call Me by Your Name. We're going to be big with them, probably. Mm-hmm. The Big Sick is only made for $5 million, which surprised me because it really feels like a bigger Hollywood movie, but that could do well there. Basically, every movie that's in the Oscar race is going to be
up
for these. The Shape of Water, I think the Shape of Water will probably qualify, because although I think it was Guillermo del Toro saw that the budget was about to go over $20 million, so in order to prevent that from happening, he gave up his own salary and to keep the budget under $20
million. I think it might be a little too Hollywood for them, for the Spirit Awards. Like, I just have a feeling, since the way that they all were very snooty regarding the Gothams and Shape of Water, I think that they're going to steer clear of movies, which is fine with me, because that just ups its Oscar cred. You know, I think that the age of Spirit Awards Oscar crossover might be coming to an end. I think we're ready for a change. And
I wonder, we need to look into that. It might make a good post for the site, just to see when that happened. For a long time, it seemed like the Saturday night before the Oscars, when the Spirit Awards were handed out, in all the movies that won Spirit Awards, that was almost like the kiss of death for the Oscars. Sideways is a good example. Then, you knew that if it won a bunch of Spirit Awards, that it was not going to do well the next night at the Oscars. But then it changed, I think, possibly with The Artist. The Artist cleaned up really big at the Spirit Awards, and then did well at the Oscars too. And then since then, it's been more of a trend where they match up more often.
Like, I mean, I know a decade ago, the Spirit Awards were basically a kiss of death because I know Sideways swept there, and then Brokeback Mountain the next year as well swept the Spirit Awards, in addition to basically every other award for Oscar night, and it famously lost to Crash. So
I was really bummed out the night that Silver Linings Playbook beat Beasts of the Southern Wild. That one really bothered me. But so that's when I think it, for me, that's when it started to really shift, when Silver Linings Playbook did really well there. I thought, okay, something's definitely different now at the Spirit Awards than it used to be. It's much more mainstream kind of Hollywood. And so I'm starting to think that maybe, you know, like Birdman winning, you know, didn't Birdman win there instead of Boyhood? Birdman won instead of Boyhood. Like, come on. Boyhood should have won there.
It looks like if any group was going to respect and admire what Boyhood did on the budget that it did, that it would be at the Spirit Awards. But instead, they went the same way that the Oscars went.
Mm-hmm. They did.
But five out of the last six Spirit Award winners have won Best Pictures. So the only one.
Yeah, and I'm looking now. What you said, Sasha, about Silver Linings Playbook.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part of what Marshall said. What did you say, the last part?
Everything except for Silver Linings Playbook, in the past, it has won. Five out of the six past Spirit Award winners have went on to win Best Picture. So
five out of six.
So Artist, 12 Years a Slave, of course, Birdman, Spotlight, and last year's Moonlight. So five out of the last six.
Wow.
Wow.
And it's strange, because Silver Linings Playbook does not feel like an independent film to me. Does it? Compared to the other things that it was nominated up against that year, for instance, for Best Feature, what else was nominated for Best Feature that year? I see now: Beast of the Southern Wild, Moonrise Kingdom, Keep the Lights On, and Bernie. Bernie. It's a different connotations
different,
now than
different
it had back.
Bernie, but I remember Bernie. That film too.
So. We should remake Bernie.
strange little film.
So that's weird, you know. That's a really weird. I think what we're seeing is because of the focus on the awards, and like you said, Ryan, anybody can be a member. You're starting to see more like a consensus vote. That's a consensus vote across the board, and that there's no real difference between the people who vote for the Spirit Awards and the people who vote for the Oscars, you know?
That's right. And even, and like, and if they, if they're only going by just strictly on budget about what makes an independent film, as long as a studio can keep their budget under 20 million, no matter how, what kind of star power or what kind of power behind the camera, like a David O. Russell or whatever, it can still qualify as an independent film. And those kind of movies to me are not the first thing I think of when I think of an independent film.
Right, me either. I mean, ideally, the independent spirit is about, you know, what Boyhood was, you know, like that, or Beasts of the Southern Wilds, or even Get Out, I guess, like these movies that take really big risks, you know, and do something that's never been done before. That, to me, is what independent spirit means. But I don't think people vote like that. I really don't. I think they just vote for what they like, no matter what, you know, and they'll always pick the movie that they like. So unless the, you know, if the Spirit Awards and the Oscars match, what are you guys thinking is going to even win Best Picture this year at the Oscars?
I mean, officially, you know, in our, or whatever awards daily Oscar group we have, I'm still putting Dunkirk officially as number one on virtue that it is still my number one film of the year. But, you know, I'm not really betting on anything right now because, like, right now, everything, it's really up in the air. I mean, three billboards seems to have a lot of traction and buzz. Lady Bird has a lot of buzz as well. So there's a lot of indie stuff. And then, you know, Dunkirk stole. Well, as I said, it's still looming large, you know, as the film that could win a butt, which get a lot of tech nominations as well. And it's still certainly a possibility for a lot of recognition above the line. But you know, as you said, though, like some of like the big things like, Darkest Hour, Darkest Hour, that it doesn't seem to have quite the critical reception it needed. I mean, outside of Gary Oldman's performance, then, you know, The Post, screenings are going to drop here soon, but, you know, it's still kind of an unknown as well. So, I mean, right now the focus on the race seems to be around Three Billboards and Lady Bird.
I think Darkest Hour still is up there in the top. In the top three or four, because of the gravity of the subject and I haven't seen it yet, but just going by what you said, Sasha, that it is surprisingly cinematic, and for a subject that's like a movie that takes place all indoors, and there's a lot of talking and discussing and a lot of exposition about things that are, you know, that you have to be spoken about. It makes those things cinematic because of the way that it's shot and edited.
Yeah, but see, the critics have this. They always have, like, they need to sort of, you know, reject what they think of as their parents' movie. Mm. So they think of the Oscars as like Oscar bait, and if they declare a movie, that's why 12 Years a Slave had such a hard time, was because it was deemed an Oscar frontrunner out of Telluride, and the critics kind of turned on it, and that's why all those pundits were predicting Gravity in 12 years, because it had lost so much momentum. And that's why it's can be misleading to go by what is happening in the I wear Tom's shoes and, you know, hipster glasses, and, you know, I voted for Bernie and I'm a vegan and I really loved Lady Bird. Like, it's really, you know, it's kind of dangerous to follow that kind of thinking, because that's not usually how a big consensus will vote necessarily, because critics represent a little bubble, you know, of people. The Spirit Awards seem to reflect that little bubble, but the greater Hollywood, the Guild, SAG-AFTRA, you know, SAG-AFTRA is like 150,000 people all over the country in different walks of life. I mean, they're all in show business, but when they pick their nominating committee, they're not going to be, as we found out, Marshall and I were on Twitter and we found this out, it's not just actors that pick that. It's not just actors. It's everybody except for voice, or except for radio. And so, you know, whatever movie that they pick, those people are going to have to like it also. And then, you know, like what Dave Karger would call Joe the Sound Guy, You know, he has to like it. It's like when you're talking about people always think that the Academy is really just what the critics think, and it's not. I mean, it can be, and it sometimes does, but it really has to be a movie that everybody likes, you know, that the critics like, and
I'm not
those people.
Sure what you're, I'm not sure what you're referring to when you said what you and Marshall found out on Twitter. But I, well, as soon as AFTRA joined SAG, AFTRA is radio people, and I was under the understanding that they also get SAG-AFTRA ballots, and they're not even actors. They're radio personalities. Some of them are broadcasters.
Some guy wrote me and said he's a member, and they separate out SAG-AFTRA is one union. But AFTRA is not just, I think it's television too.
Mm-hmm.
There's I don't really remember it, but like Tom O'Neill is a member of AFTRA. You know, so it's like, because he did some TV appearances.
AFTRA stands for the American Federation for Television. Radio Artists.
Yeah, that's why I was thinking everyone who's on radio, which are certainly not actors. Or they get a ballot. I was under that understanding that they get a ballot.
Because Screen Actors Guild, like the Screen Actors Guild, is really supposed to be just screen actors, but it's not. It's not anymore. So, basically, what I'm saying is we don't really know who those people are that are going to be picked. But generally speaking, it's a good idea to remember that the movie that they like has to. I mean, yes, they get fed the information that we're all getting right now, which is these same movies being churned around. Mm-hmm. With no other movies being let in, which is this year it's become a problem, I think, that we've become so narrow-minded in our thinking because we're really running out of movies. You know, we have a very short list of films that have been deemed acceptable by the very critical Oscar blogger group and the critics, and that is a very shrinking pile. You know, we need a much bigger pile, ideally, but we don't have that. So maybe some of these awards, the Golden Globes, the Producers Guild, maybe some of them will bring some of these movies in.
Exactly. I wanted to say that I wasn't trying to disparage the AFTRA members. If they get a ballot, and if they've gotten a ballot for the past 3 or 4 years, they're responsible for nominating movies like Hidden Figures and Beast of No Nation and Idris Elba that the Oscars overlooked. So they've done a good job. And whatever the difference in their demographic is from the Oscars, I'm not critical of it because they have done a really good job with their nominees and their winners.
And sometimes it's hit and miss because remember they picked Captain Fantastic over La La Land, and that was odd.
Right. Yeah.
But who would have thought that? Like, I never would have thought that. That's why when people predict the SAG, like, it's either going to be totally predictable, we get like 4 out of 5 right, or it's going to be one of these things where it's totally bizarre and like two movies that we think are going to, and two movies. Remember, the Spotlight year, only two movies in the SAG ensemble were nominated for Best Picture, and that was Spotlight and The Big Short. The only two. And of course, Spotlight won, which that really tested the SAG ensemble stat. That one really did, you know, because it should have been The Revenant winning that year, you know, but didn't have a SAG ensemble, which meant that they didn't like it. And it was a movie full of actors, so it should have gotten that, you know. People say, oh, they saw it late, blah, blah, blah. But I don't know about that. You know, I think that the publicists do a really good job making sure they see it. I know for a fact they didn't see Wolf of Wall Street.
Surely, once the SAG-AFTRA has chosen the 2,000 people each year who are going to be doing the nominating, that list is surely, the studios are aware of that. So they know who to send the screeners to. They don't have to send out screeners to 150,000 people. Yeah. They know who to target, surely.
Absolutely.
Don't you think?
Yeah, I do. And I think that the publicist who was on Captain Fantastic did a really good job of putting those people in front of Vigo and that cast and meeting them. You know, I think that's how that movie got nominated. I don't think that people just saw it and said, oh, that's a really good movie. I think it was more like we met the cast.
But then it's, like you said, it's really unusual that for a movie like Spotlight that is a epitome of a great ensemble piece, they overlooked, they nominated Rachel McAdams too. I was about to say they didn't, but I was going to say that the Oscars nominated Rachel McAdams where the SAG didn't, but the SAG also nominated her. So they were both on the ball with that. And it did get an ensemble nomination from the SAG too.
Absolutely, no offense, but the least deserving supporting actress nomination I've ever seen in my life. Like, I know they like her
and
everything.
As far as screen time and range and right and God, just the okay, role was
that
not
was
that.
So bizarre that happened. Yeah. I'll never understand mm-hmm. that. I think it's just because she's so pretty and they like her. That's the only reason I can think of that they would have nominated
and it was a very sympathetic character, really sympathetic character, and she held her own against all of those guys too, since she was the only woman in the cast. Maybe that held some sway over some of the female voters. I was going to cycle back to something you said earlier about the fact that sometimes a movie that everyone has gotten behind early in the year, that gloss can wear off by the time that the awards are upon us. And a lot of us started saying that Dunkirk was going to be Best Picture the weekend it opened, and that was back in July or something, right? So I'm really starting to think that that would be, if I have to play devil's advocate at all about Dunkirk and Darkest Hour both, although we've talked a lot about how they both have the gravitas that we would normally expect from an Oscar-winning Best Picture, Dunkirk, it did really well with critics when it first came out, but I don't know that it's going to hold up against some of the newer, the fresher movies that we're going to see between now and Christmas.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know me, you guys. I always go with my little stats that I use to judge, mm-hmm. and I don't step out of that, really. I know that eventually all my little things I use are going to get broken and blown up, but right now they haven't been, which is SAG Ensemble, Shonen mm-hmm. Telluride, you know, The Girl Next Door versus, you know, The Girl of the Moment. It's sort of changed. The preferential ballot has sort of changed that. It's not a miss right now kind of thing. It's more like a miss right, because people have time to think about it and it settles in. Like Moonlight did well, not because it surged at the last minute, but because it was a movie that steadily went along and people loved it and no one hated it and they were rooting for it, right? Mm-hmm. So you got to find that movie. Well, as I've said millions and millions of times, it's either going to be two types of wins, right? Best Picture is either going to be a Birdman kind of win where one movie, one director takes the whole season, wins the Producers Guild, the Directors Guild, SAG Ensemble, and then the Oscar, and it can't be beat. And so it doesn't even matter if it's divisive or what, because it wins on the first round. Everybody in the mm-hmm. Academy likes it, right? The other way is the Moonlight way, the Spotlight way, the 12 Years a Slave way, where there is a split and people don't like the front runner, and or they like it but they don't like it, and there's another movie and they're deciding and this and that. Last year was really hard because there were a lot of movies people really loved and were split on. Like a lot of people loved Arrival, a lot of, you know, you could tell mm-hmm. and the same with the Revenant year. Mad Max was pushing through. Mad Max was causing friction there, and so maybe if Mad Max hadn't been in the race, the Revenant might have had a better shot. But that was a third movie that was dividing the vote, and if we have that this year, if we have a lot of competition, if there's not just one movie, like let's say Get Out starts to win everything, let's say it wins the Gotham, it dominates the Spirit Awards, it gets a DGA nomination, PGA, and SAG Ensemble, right? Jordan Peele is really funny at the mic and he wins something, you know? He gets up there and he starts talking, everybody loves him, and all of a sudden all of our problems are solved. There's one movie that everybody likes and everybody wants to unite behind. Everybody feels good about awarding him. They feel like they're doing their duty. It feels like it's anti-Trump. You know, everything about it is clicking into place, and then boom, it wins the PGA, wins the DGA, wins the SAG Ensemble, wins the Oscar, and that's the end of it, right? Mm-hmm. But let's say Jordan Peele doesn't get a DGA nomination, you know? Let's say Greta Gerwig doesn't get a nomination in DGA. That's cross off Get Out, cross off Lady Bird. You know, really DGA, SAG, PGA, it still always comes down to those three guilds. So I think it can go either way. I don't, like you guys say, I don't really know what movie is going to be. I know that the themes we're all working with right now are feminism, racism, you know, those themes are still in there. Anti-Trump is in there. traditionally speaking, the Oscars like movies about good people doing good things, you know? Mm-hmm. And that could be Three Billboards, you know? Problem with Three Billboards is it's really not PC with its language. So that's going to be trouble for it, I think, if there's any sort of disagreement, you know, like they use the N-word, they say call somebody a retard. There's a lot of, you know, language that might put
right, and that doesn't seem to bother people who, when they vote for best screenplay, because we have seen movies like that, like Tarantino films and Whiplash, that didn't impede their winning Oscars. But when it comes to best picture, people have a different attitude about it, because I think the Oscar voters are aware of the fact that this is going to represent what they feel like is. It represents Hollywood at the moment, represents the industry to its best advantage. And I'm not sure that, like, I think that you're right, that there, a lot of voters are going to have reservations about it for that reason.
That this is possible. We don't know. And Call Me By Your Name has that other problem we talked about, you know, which could be a problem, might not be a problem, you know, who knows?
Which is, we want to make clear, because people just get bristled up about this so quickly.
Yeah, I know.
Obviously, everybody knows it's not a problem for us. The subject of the movie is not a problem for us, and it's not a problem for anybody who knows anyone who's gay or who's been gay as a teenager. But we're thinking about what some of the Oscar voters who are older white men who are 70 and 80 years old, what they're going to think about it, because we have seen what they have thought about movies like this in the past.
Or some gay men, by the way. Some gay men that I've talked to also feel this way, which is that they feel uncomfortable with 17-year-old being the age of consent. Like, that's hard for them, some people. I'm not saying it is true, but it's hard for some people to accept, you know, and irrational. Voting is anonymous, and it's irrational. And so if they have any kind of weird feeling about that movie, they're not going to choose it. You know what I mean?
Right.
Whether they could talk about it at a dinner party or not, they're still not going to pick the movie if they have a weird feeling. And it's a beautiful movie, by the way. It just... have to say, it's really something special, and people should go see it. It's really, really look. Did you see it, Ryan?
Yes, just this afternoon. This afternoon, and I'm still kind of reeling from it. It's just extraordinary.
Yeah.
It's amazing that, I mean, so many things about it, the casual style of it, the unforced, the way that the message comes across before you even realize that there's a message that it's trying to get across. It's just absolutely just organic and natural. And so it sneaks up on, I'm not the type of person who really gets emotional at movies very often, but this movie really does snuck up on me at least.
It really
sneaked up on me.
Yeah.
And really it just tore my heart out by the end of it.
Me too.
That the last half hour and that last shot is amazing.
I know.
One of the greatest last shots of any film that I've seen in ages.
And, you know, we're living through such weird prudish times that, like, this is a movie that, like, because it takes place in the 80s. I think it takes place before AIDS and before.
Before
it turned into, you know, a big, huge worldwide panic, maybe, like right before that. You know, there was a lot of free love then. I know that was my high school days. I remember that before the door got slammed shut. But, you know, you have to remember that. And you know, we're living through a time where, you know, subject around sex is so uncomfortable and awkward. And the rules are so strident and stringent. And people are so weird about it that, like, it's sometimes hard to remember what it is. And I thought that Call Me By Your Name is, like, one of those movies that is really honest about that coming of age as a sexual person, not even necessarily gay, but just any person, you know, he's sort of trying everything, you know, to try to see what who he is and what he wants. And
well, when a novelist writes a story and when the filmmakers decide to stay, to be faithful to what the novelist has done, the novelist has made a decision about why he wants to set his story at a particular year. Why else would you set a movie at the very beginning of the 1980s unless you wanted to be sure that HIV wasn't part of the equation?
Right, exactly, yeah. And how it caught that moment right before, you know, what that felt like when there was really the last era of free love, you know. But boy, are the actors good in that. Timothée Chalamet and Armie Hammer are just both incredible, I thought. Armie Hammer really impressed me. I didn't people kept saying, oh, he's going to get a supporting actor. And I thought, no, come on, they're just saying that. There's no way he's that good. But I was really surprised by how good he was.
It's unbelievable, really. And what Michael Stuhlbarg does with that one particular scene at the very end, when you talk about a supporting actor or supporting actress winning on the basis of one scene, as Judi Dench did for the one scene that she had in Shakespeare in Love, this is exactly how this happens. With when you have a scene, when you have a role and a dialogue written like that, and you carry it off in a sustained scene that lasts for 5 or 7 minutes like that, that's how you win supporting actor award just for on the basis of really 7 minutes.
He's good in this, but he's better in Shape of Water. That's the thing, is he's got a much better part in Shape of Water, which
that's
still is
to look forward
Shape
to,
of Water is still my favorite film of the year, and I hope that it does better than it's doing right now in terms of the critics. I just don't have their vibe this year. I mean, Call Me By Your Name is the only movie of all the critics' favorites so far that I really, really like. You know, like the rest of them are, I like them. They're good movies, but they're just not my favorites, you know. I would put that one in my top five.
Go ahead, sorry.
I was just going to say Call Me By Your Name would for sure be in my top five.
Right, and I had not thought that I would put the directors of Call Me By Your Name. I would not have thought that I would put Luca Guadagnino among my top five for director, but now I think I might. I don't know. I haven't looked at the list, and I don't know who I would bump in favor of him, but I think what he did is amazing in this movie. Yeah. And I also think that if there's a split this year between Best Picture and Best Director, like we've seen for several of the recent years, I think that Guillermo del Toro could win Best Director, even if Shape of Water doesn't win Best Picture.
Right.
I don't know.
I don't feel like it's his year. I wish it was, but we'll see. We'll see how it goes. You know, Shape of Water fits all my criteria. Like, it was seen at Telluride. It was seen at Venice. It's about good people doing good things. It's anti-Trump. It has, you know, it has sort of that movie within a movie kind of feel, you know, show business people sort of. So, but it might just be too weird for them because it's sci-fi, you know. There's a creature.
Possibly. Yeah, but at the same time, since we were talking about the fact that a lot of times that it seems like recently the Oscar voters have gone in a different direction from what we think of as typical Oscar fare. So it might be just the right place. If Dunkirk and Darkest Hour are too much like traditional Oscar movies from the 1980s or 60s or whatever, that if they drop away, then what's left at the top, and the movie that I think that stands out above all of those that we haven't talked about it, a problem yet, would be The Shape of Water. I still have The Shape of Water in my number two position and probably my number one position for Best Director.
Even though you haven't seen it.
Even though I haven't seen it.
All right, so I have to go.
Your enthusiasm, though, Sasha, has just, it's infectious. I'm just going on the basis of what.
I have a feeling I'm going to be kind of heartbroken this year, but that's okay. It's fine. It's just 1 year. But I think we can say pretty clearly right now that the top movies are still Dunkirk, Shape of Water, Darkest Hour, Lady Bird, Get Out, Three Billboards, not in order, by the way. Mm-hmm. Just naming them. And Call Me By Your Name, which I worry about a little bit with Oscar.
And we're worried about Mudbound. The reason we haven't talked about Mudbound is because it is associated with its own set of problems that we're just not even sure yet how the Oscars are willing to accept a Netflix film yet. And we have to just keep all of us who feel so strongly about this movie and how great it is. I read someone of our followers today on Twitter said that it's when you talk about a movie becoming an instant classic, that's what this is. When this movie ends, you say to yourself, I have just seen a new classic film. Especially when you see it a second time, it all comes together, don't you think?
Yeah, it distresses me a little bit that there are two movies directed by women this year that are getting any sort of attention, and that's Lady Bird and this one. And they're really falling all over themselves for Lady Bird, but they're not giving Mudbound any sort of that same amount of attention, which bothers me. But I can tell you this, I pulled out all the stops for Beasts of No Nation to try to get that thing nominated, and that they were not going to budge. They were not going to budge on that. So they might still be prejudiced against Netflix, but you know what? Can't stop what's coming. The industry's changing. There's no changing it back, you know?
That's right.
I don't know what they're going to do with Mudbound. I wish that they would pick the movie. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. Who knows? But
It's so funny. I was just flipping through Netflix last night, and Sunset Boulevard is streaming this week. And so I you can't watch just 5 minutes of that movie. Mm. Once you start watching it, you've got to just watch it. And so I watched it again for like the 15th or 16th time. And it's funny to me that she's saying. She's talking about the way that films changed and the way the sound and color ruined movies, you know, and that's what people are saying now about Netflix, that Netflix is ruining movies because of the so different from anything that anyone has experienced before. And that's what Norma Desmond was saying about sound and color.
I know, it's true.
And I'm sure a lot of people back then did think that, because there were people who thought, well, silent film is an art form that is being destroyed. And so, and whatever comes after silent films cannot possibly match what silent films gave us. And that's what people are now saying about movies that appear on different platforms. And that's really the only difference is just where are they first seen by people is the only difference between a movie like Mudbound and a movie like 12 Years a Slave is where they're first screened. Well, and that's just absurd to me.
What did you guys think of it? What did you think of the movie, Marshall? Did you like it?
Oh, I watched it last week, weekend, and I loved it. I draw a lot of comparisons with that to The Grapes of Wrath. It's kind of like in similar time period, maybe like 20 years later, but you know, it has like a similar feel to Steinbeck novel, and of course John Ford's adaptation of it. But there's also some kind of there's a lyricism that kind of reminds me of Tennessee Williams or William Faulkner that runs throughout the film as well. But you know, it's a great achievement. Dee Reese really marks the ascension of Dee Reese as a directorial talent to watch out for. The ensemble is great through and through. It's really a true ensemble movie. I mean I guess if you want to say if there's some leads, it would be like Jason Mitchell and Garrett Hedlund, but that would throughout the ensemble is great. They all, the way it comes together at the end, kind of in a tragic way, but it doesn't end on a downer note, certainly, but although there's some tragedy involved. But yeah, it's a great film. It's one of my favorite films of the year. Certainly, I do hope. I wasn't really big on Beast of the Southern Wild, although I certainly respected it. But this film from Mudbound, I have no reservations on. So I'm certainly rooting for it to get all the accolades it can get. Certainly for the Oscars, SAG was pretty forward-looking with embracing A Beast of the Southern Wild a couple of years ago, so I do hope that Mudbound resonates with the voters there as well. And if you could get with SAG, it'll certainly have a chance with the Oscars, I think.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, it needs PGA, and at the very minimum, it needs PGA and it needs SAG. And if it can get those two things, it can get a Best Picture nomination.
I think it's got SAG from all different angles. I like that it's such an ensemble that they're the FYC, the screener that came out, and all the FYC ads, they're not running anyone as lead. They're running all of the actors, all of the actors as supporting equally.
I was surprised by that too. Boy, is Carrie Mulligan good in that. Like, you just never hear anything about her, and she's so good. You know, she just has this tiny part, but she's just great.
So surprising to see, because it's unlike anything she's ever done before. She usually plays a fairly more sophisticated type person. But you know what you said a minute ago, Marshall, about it being Faulkner-esque. I had not thought about that, but you're so right. It's so much like something Faulkner would write. And the time period is barely different, because when The Grapes of Wrath was written in, 1939?
And then
this movie takes place just 3 years later. 3 or 4 years later, so it's virtually the same time period. And even though that's a bit of a different type of part of the country, and the destitution of the families is different for a different reason, it is still the most downtrodden and hardscrabble part of the country at that time in America was right there, and they were fighting the elements and the earth in the same way that they did in The Grapes of Wrath.
Yeah. Well, it was lovely talking with you guys. I'm going to have to get off the phone only because my dogs are causing a ruckus right now, and they're going to want to go out, and I have to.
And you've got the Post to go see.
And I've got the Post to go see, yes. I have to, haul my ass out there.
Okay, yeah, have a good time tonight.
Okay,
have
thanks. Okay, bye. Bye. Thanks for listening to All This and the Oscars Too, a shorter podcast than usual. We appreciate your feedback. So you can write us on Twitter. For me, it's at Awards Daily. Ryan is at Film Mystic. And Marshall is I Prefer Pie, P-I. And you can always leave a review on iTunes. That helps us a lot. And we read each one of them. And we appreciate it. And hope you have a nice holiday weekend. Thanks for listening.